he murmured. The muscles in my shoulders tensed with concern. Trust me, he said quietly into my ear. I've got you. My eyes remained tightly closed, and I sighed happily. We continued to swirl together. Matthew gently released me, spinning me out to the end of his fingers, then rolled me back along his arm until I came to rest, my back tight against his chest. The music stopped. Open your eyes, he said softly. My eyelids slowly lifted. The feeling of floating remained. Dancing was better than I had expected it to be. At least it was with a partner who'd been dancing for more than a millennium and never stepped on your toes. I tilted my face up to thank him, but his was much closer than expected. Look down, Matthew said. Turning my head in the other direction revealed that my toes were dangling several inches above the floor. Matthew released me. He wasn't holding me up. I was holding me up. The air was holding me up. With that realization, the weight returned to the lower half of my body. Matthew gripped both elbows to keep my feet from smashing into the floor. From her seat by the fire, Mart hummed a tune under her breath. Isabeau's head whipped around, eyes narrowed. Matthew smiled at me reassuringly while I concentrated on the uncanny feeling of the earth under my feet. Had the ground always seemed so alive? It was as if a thousand tiny hands were waiting under the soles of my shoes to catch me or give me a push. Was it fun? Matthew asked, as the last notes of Mart's song faded, eyes gleaming. It was, I answered, laughing, after considering his question. I hoped it would be. You've been practicing for years. Now maybe you'll ride with your eyes open for a change. He caught me up in an embrace full of happiness and possibility. Isabeau began to sing the same song Mart had been humming. Whoever sees her dance and her body move so gracefully could say, in truth, that in all the world she has no equal, our joyful queen. Go away, jealous ones. Let us dance together. Together. Go away, jealous ones, Matthew repeated as the final echo of his mother's voice faded. Let us dance together. I laughed again. With you, I'll dance. But until I figure out how this flying business works, there will be no other partners. Properly speaking, you were floating, not flying, Matthew corrected me. Floating, flying, whatever you call it, it would be best not to do it with strangers. Agreed, he said. Mart had vacated the sofa for a chair near Isabeau. Matthew and I sat together, our hands still entwined. This was her first time? Isabeau asked him, her voice genuinely puzzled. Diana doesn't use magic, Maman, except for little things, he explained. She is full of power, Mathieu. A witch's blood sings in her veins. She should be able to use it for big things, too. He frowned. It's hers to use or not. Enough of such childishness, she said, turning her attention to me. It is time for you to grow up, Diana, and accept responsibility for who you are. Matthew growled softly. Do not growl at me, Mathieu de Clermont. I am saying what needs to be said. You're telling her what to do. It's not your job. Nor yours, my son, Isabeau retorted. Excuse me. My sharp tone caught their attention, and the de Clermonts, mother and son, stared at me. It's my decision whether and how to use my magic. But, I said, turning to Isabeau, it can't be ignored any longer. It seems to be bubbling out of me. I need to learn how to control my power at the very least. Isabeau and Matthew continued to stare. Finally, Isabeau nodded. Matthew did too. We continued to sit by the fire until the logs burned down. Matthew danced with Mart, and each of them broke into song occasionally when a piece of music reminded them of another night by another fire. But I didn't dance again, and Matthew didn't press me. Finally, he stood. I am taking the only one of us who needs her sleep up to bed. I stood as well, smoothing my trousers against my thighs. Good night, Isabeau. Good night, Mart. Thank you both for a lovely dinner and a surprising evening. Mart gave me a smile in return. Isabeau did her best, but managed only a tight grimace. Matthew let me lead the way and put his hand gently against the small of my back as we climbed the stairs. I might read for a bit, I said, turning to face him when we reached his study. He was directly behind me, so close that the faint, ragged sound of his breath was audible. He took my face in his hands. What spell have you put on me? He searched my face. It's not simply your eyes, though they do make it impossible for me to think straight, or the fact that you smell like honey. He buried his face in my neck, the fingers of one hand sliding into my hair while the other drifted down my back, pulling my hips toward him. My body softened into his, as if it were meant to fit there. It's your fearlessness, he murmured against my skin, and the way you move without thinking, and the shimmer you give off when you concentrate, or when you fly. My neck arched, exposing more flesh to his touch. Matthew slowly turned my face toward him, his thumb seeking out the warmth of my lips. Did you know your mouth puckers when you sleep? You look as though you might be displeased with your dreams, but I prefer to think you wish to be kissed. He sounded more French with each word that he spoke. Aware of Isabeau's disapproving presence downstairs, as well as her acute, vampiric hearing, I tried to pull away. It wasn't convincing, and Matthew's arms tightened. Matthew, your mother... He gave me no chance to complete my sentence. With a soft, satisfied sound, he deliberately fitted his lips to mine and kissed me, gently but thoroughly, until my entire body, not just my hands, was tingling. I kissed him back, feeling a simultaneous sense of floating and falling until I had no clear awareness of where my body ended and his began. His mouth drifted to my cheeks and eyelids. When it brushed against my ear, I gasped. Matthew's lips curved into a smile, and he pressed them once more against my own. Your lips are as red as poppies, and your hair is so alive, he said when he was quite finished kissing me, with an intensity that left me breathless. What is it with you and my hair? Why anyone with a head of hair like yours would be impressed with this, I said, grabbing a fistful of it and pulling it, is beyond me. Isabeau's hair looks like satin, so does Mart's. Mine is a mess. Every color of the rainbow and badly behaved as well. That's why I love it, Matthew said, gently freeing the strands. It's imperfect, just like life. It's not vampire hair, all polished and flawless. I like that you're not a vampire, Diana. And I like that you are a vampire, Matthew. A shadow flitted across his eyes, gone in a moment. I like your strength, I said, kissing him with the same enthusiasm as he had kissed me. I like your intelligence. Sometimes I even like your bossiness, but most of all... I rubbed the tip of my nose gently against his. I like the way you smell.
You do?
I do. My nose went into the hollow between his collarbones, which I was fast learning was the spiciest, sweetest part of him.
It's late. You need your rest.
He released me reluctantly. Come to bed with me. His eyes widened with surprise at the invitation, and the blood coursed to my face. Matthew brought my hand to his heart. It beat once, powerfully.
I will come up, he said, but not to stay. We have time, Diana. You've known me for only a few weeks. There's no need to rush.
Spoken like a vampire. He saw my dejection and drew me closer for another lingering kiss. A promise, he said when he was finished, of what's to come. In time. It was time, but my lips were alternately freezing and burning, making me wonder for a fleeting second if I was as ready as I thought. Upstairs, the room was ablaze with candles and warm from the fire. How Mart had managed to get up here, change dozens of candles and light them so that they would still be burning at bedtime was a mystery, but the room didn't have a single electrical outlet, so I was doubly grateful for her efforts. Changing in the bathroom behind a partially closed door, I listened to Matthew's plans for the next day. These involved a long walk, another long ride, and more work in the study. I agreed to all of it, provided that the work came first. The alchemical manuscript was calling to me, and I was eager to get a closer look at it. I got into Matthew's vast four-poster, and he tightened the sheets around my body before pinching out the candles. "Sing to me," I said, watching his long fingers fearlessly move through the flames. "An old song, one Mart likes." Her wicked fondness for love songs hadn't gone unnoticed. He was quiet for a few moments while he walked through the room, snuffing the candles and trailing shadows behind him as the room fell into darkness. He began to sing in his rich baritone. Ni moi ni vieux ne guaris, ni mal nom sent et si la gran, quardes amour no suis devis, ni no sai, j'en aurai ni quan, ken lies est tuta le mercés, quem pot sorcer o decacer. The song was full of yearning and teetered on the edge of sadness. By the time he returned to my side, the song was finished. Matthew left one candle burning next to the bed. "What do the words mean?" I reached for his hand. "Not dying, nor living, nor healing. There is no pain in my sickness, for I am not kept from her love." He leaned down and kissed me on the forehead. I don't know if I will ever have it, for all the mercy that makes me flourish or decay is in her power. "Who wrote that?" I asked, struck by the aptness of the words when sung by a vampire. "My father wrote it for Isabeau. Someone else took the credit, though," Matthew said, his eyes gleaming and his smile bright and content. He hummed the song under his breath as he went downstairs. I lay in his bed, alone, and watched the last candle burn until it guttered out. Chapter 21. A vampire holding a breakfast tray greeted me the next morning after my shower. "I told Mart you wanted to work this morning," Matthew explained, lifting the cover that was keeping the food warm. "You two are spoiling me." I unfolded the napkin waiting on a nearby chair. "I don't think your character is in any real danger." Matthew stooped and gave me a lingering kiss, his eyes smoky. "Good morning. Did you sleep well?" "Very well." I took the plate from his hands, my cheeks reddening at the memory of the invitation I'd extended to him last night. There was still a twinge of hurt when I recalled his gentle rebuff, but this morning's kiss confirmed that we had slipped past the limits of friendship and were moving in a new direction. After my breakfast, we headed downstairs, turned on our computers, and got to work. Matthew had left a perfectly ordinary 19th-century copy of an early English translation of the Vulgate Bible on the table next to his manuscript. "Thank you," I called over my shoulder, holding it up. "I found it downstairs. Apparently the one I have isn't good enough for you." He grinned. "I absolutely refuse to treat a Gutenberg Bible as a reference book, Matthew." My voice came out more sternly than anticipated, making me sound like a schoolmarm. "I know the Bible backwards and forwards. If you have a question, you could just ask me," he suggested. "I'm not using you as a reference book either." "Suit yourself," he said with a shrug and another smile. With my computer at my side and an alchemical manuscript before me, I was soon absorbed in reading, analyzing, and recording my ideas. There was one distracting incident when I asked Matthew for something to weigh down the book's pages while I type. He rummaged around and found a bronze medal with the likeness of Louis XIV on it, and a small wooden foot that he claimed came from a German angel. He wouldn't surrender the two objects without sureties for their return. Finally, he was satisfied by several more kisses. Aurora Consurgence was one of the most beautiful texts in the alchemical tradition, a meditation on the female figure of wisdom, as well as an exploration of the chemical reconciliation of opposing natural forces. The text in Matthew's copy was nearly identical to the copies I'd consulted in Zurich, Glasgow, and London, but the illustrations were quite different. The artist, Bourgault Lenoir, had been a true master of her craft. Each illumination was precise and beautifully executed, but her talent didn't lie simply in technical mastery. Her depictions of the female characters showed a different sensibility. Bourgault's wisdom was full of strength, but there was a softness to her as well. In the first illumination, where wisdom shielded the personification of the seven metals in her cloak, she bore an expression of fierce, maternal pride. There were two illuminations, just as Matthew had promised, that weren't included in any known copy of Aurora Consurgence. Both appeared in the final parable, devoted to the chemical wedding of gold and silver. The first accompanied words spoken by the female principal in alchemical change, often represented as a queen dressed in white with emblems of the moon to show her association with silver. She had been transformed by Bourgault into a beautiful, terrifying creature with silvery snakes instead of hair, her face shadowed like a moon eclipsed by the sun. Silently, I read the accompanying text, translating the Latin into English. "Turn to me with all your heart. Do not refuse me because I am dark and shadowed. The fire of the sun has altered me. The seas have encompassed me. The earth has been corrupted because of my work. Night fell over the earth when I sank into the miry deep, and my substance was hidden. The moon queen held a star in one outstretched palm. From the depths of the water I cried out to you, and from the depths of the earth I will call to those who pass by me," I continued. "Watch for me. See me. And if you find another who is like me, I will give him the morning star." My lips formed the words, and Bourgault's illumination brought the text to life in the Moon Queen's expression that showed both her fear of rejection and her shy pride. The second unique illumination came on the next page and accompanied the words spoken by the male principal, the Golden Sun King. The hair on my neck rose at Bourgault's depiction of a heavy stone sarcophagus, its lid open just enough to reveal a golden body lying within. The king's eyes were closed peacefully, and there was a look of hope on his face as if he were dreaming of his release. "I will rise now and go about the city. In its streets I will seek out a pure woman to marry," I read, "her face beautiful, her body more beautiful, her raiment most beautiful. She will roll away the stone from the entrance of my tomb and give me the wings of a dove so that I might fly with her to the heavens to live forever and be at rest." The passage reminded me of Matthew's badge from Bethany and Lazarus's tiny silver coffin. I reached for the Bible. "Mark 16, Psalms 55 and Deuteronomy 32, verse 40. Matthew's voice cut through the quiet, spouting references like an automated biblical concordance. "How did you know what I was reading?" I twisted in my chair to get a better view of him. "Your lips were moving," he replied, staring fixedly at his computer screen, his fingers clattering on the keys. Pressing my lips together, I returned to the text. The author had drawn on every biblical passage that fit the alchemical story of death and creation, paraphrasing and cobbling them together. I pulled the Bible across the desk. It was bound in black leather, and a gold cross adorned the cover. Opening it to the Gospel of Mark, I scanned chapter 16. There it was. Mark chapter 16, verse 3. "And they said to one another, 'Who shall roll us back the stone from the door of the sepulchre?'" "Find it?" Matthew inquired mildly. "Yes." "Good." The room grew silent once more. "Where is the verse about the morning star?" Sometimes my pagan background was a serious professional liability. "Revelation 2, verse 28. "Thank you." "My pleasure." A smothered laugh came from the other desk. I bent my head to the manuscript and ignored it. After 2 hours of reading tiny Gothic handwriting and searching for corresponding biblical references, I was more than ready to go riding when Matthew suggested it was time for a break. As an added bonus, He promised to tell me over lunch how he knew the 17th century physiologist William Harvey.
It's not a very interesting story, Matthew had protested. Maybe not to you, but to a historian of science, it's the closest thing I'll get to meeting the man who figured out that the heart is a pump.
We hadn't seen the sun since we'd arrived at Settur, but neither of us minded. Matthew seemed more relaxed, and I was surprisingly happy to be out of Oxford. Gillian's threats, the pictures of my parents, even Peter Knox, they all receded with each hour that passed. As we walked out into the gardens, Matthew chatted animatedly about a problem at work that involved a missing strand of something that should have been present in a blood sample but wasn't. He sketched out a chromosome in the air in an effort to explain, pointing to the offending area, and I nodded even though what was at stake remained mysterious. The words continued to roll out of his mouth, and he put an arm around my shoulder, drawing me close. We rounded a line of hedges. A man in black stood outside the gate we'd passed through yesterday on our ride. The way he leaned against a chestnut tree, with the elegance of a leopard on the prowl, suggested he was a vampire. Matthew scooped me behind him. The man pulled himself gracefully away from the tree's rough trunk and strolled toward us. The fact that he was a vampire was now confirmed by his unnaturally white skin and huge, dark eyes, emphasized by his black leather jacket, jeans, and boots. This vampire didn't care who knew he was different. His wolfish expression was the only imperfection in an otherwise angelic face, with symmetrical features and dark hair worn curling low onto his collar. He was smaller and slighter than Matthew, but the power he exuded was undeniable. His eyes sent coldness deep under my skin, where it spread like a stain.
Domenico, Matthew said calmly, though his voice was louder than usual. Matthew?
The glance the vampire turned on Matthew was full of hate.
It's been years.
Matthew's casual tone suggested that the vampire's sudden appearance was an everyday occurrence. Domenico looked thoughtful.
When was that? In Ferrara. We were both fighting the Pope, though for different reasons, as I remember. I was trying to save Venice. You were trying to save the Templars.
Matthew nodded slowly, his eyes fixed on the other vampire. I think you must be right.
After that, my friend, you seemed to disappear. We shared so many adventures in our youth, on the seas, in the Holy Land. Venice was always full of amusements for a vampire such as you, Matthew.
Domenico shook his head in apparent sorrow. The vampire inside the chateau gate did look Venetian, or like some unholy cross between an angel and a devil.
Why did you not come and visit me when you passed between France and one of your other haunts? If I caused offense, Domenico, it was surely too long ago to be of any concern to us now. Perhaps, but one thing hasn't changed in all these years. Whenever there's a crisis, there's a de Clermont nearby.
He turned to me, and something avaricious bloomed on his face.
This must be the witch I've heard so much about.
Diana, go back to the house, Matthew said sharply.
The sense of danger was palpable, and I hesitated, not wanting to leave him alone.
Go, he said again, his voice as keen-edged as a sword.
Our vampire visitor spotted something over my shoulder and smiled. An icy breeze brushed past me, and a cold, hard arm linked through mine.
Domenico, chimed Isabeau's musical voice. What an unexpected visit.
He bowed formally. My lady, it is a pleasure to see you in such good health. How did you know I was here?
I smelled you, Isabeau said contemptuously. You come here, to my house, uninvited?
What would your mother say if she knew you behaved in such a fashion? If my mother was still alive, we could ask her, Domenico said with barely concealed savagery. Maman, take Diana back to the house.
Of course, Mathieu. We will leave the two of you to talk.
Isabeau turned, tugging me along with her.
I'll be gone more quickly if you let me deliver my message, Domenico warned. If I have to come back, I won't be alone. Today's visit was a courtesy to you, Isabeau.
She doesn't have the book, Matthew said sharply.
I'm not here about the witch's damn book, Matthew. Let them keep it. I've come from the congregation.
Isabeau exhaled, soft and long, as if she'd been holding her breath for days. A question burbled to my lips, but she silenced it with a warning look.
Well done, Domenica. I'm surprised you have time to call on old friends with all your new responsibilities.
Matthew's voice was scornful.
Why is the congregation wasting time paying official visits on the de Clermont family when there are vampires leaving bloodless corpses all over Europe for humans to find?
It's not forbidden for vampires to feed on humans, though the carelessness is regrettable. As you know, death follows vampires wherever we go.
Domenico shrugged off the brutality, and I shivered at his casual disregard for frail, warm-blooded life.
But the Covenant clearly forbids any liaison between a vampire and a witch.
I turned and stared at Domenico.
What did you say?
She can speak.
Domenico clasped his hands in mock delight.
Why not let the witch take part in this conversation?
Matthew reached around and drew me forward. Isabeau remained entwined through my other arm. We stood in a short, tight line of vampire, witch, and vampire.
Diana Bishop.
Domenico bowed low.
It is an honor to meet a witch of such ancient, distinguished lineage. So few of the old families are still with us.
Every word he uttered, no matter how formally phrased, sounded like a threat.
Who are you? I asked. And why are you concerned with whom I spend time?
The Venetian looked at me with interest before his head fell back and he howled with laughter.
They said you were argumentative like your father, but I didn't believe them.
My fingers tingled slightly, and Isabeau's arm grew fractionally tighter.
Have I made your witch angry?
Domenico's eyes were fixed on Isabeau's arm.
Say what you came to say and get off our land.
Matthew's voice was entirely conversational.
My name is Domenico Michele. I have known Matthew since I was reborn, and Isabeau nearly as long. I know neither of them so well as I knew the lovely Louisa, of course. But we should not speak lightly of the dead.
The Venetian crossed himself piously.
You should try not to speak of my sister at all.
Matthew sounded calm, but Isabeau looked murderous, her lips white.
You still haven't answered my question, I said, drawing Domenico's attention once more.
The Venetian's eyes glittered with frank appraisal.
Diana, Matthew said, unable to stop the rumble in his throat.
It was as close as he'd ever been to growling at me. Mart came out of the kitchen, a look of alarm on her face.
She is more fiery than most of her kind, I see. Is that why you're risking everything to keep her with you? Does she amuse you? Or do you intend to feed on her until you get bored and then discard her, as you have with other warm bloods?
Matthew's hand strayed to Lazarus's coffin, evident only as a bump under his sweater. He hadn't touched it since we'd arrived at Set Tour. Domenico's keen eyes noticed the gesture too, and his answering smile was vindictive.
Feeling guilty?
Furious at the way Domenico was baiting Matthew, I opened my mouth to speak.
Diana, go back to the house immediately.
Matthew's tone suggested that we would have a serious, unpleasant talk later. He pushed me slightly in Isabeau's direction and put himself even more squarely between his mother, me, and the dark Venetian. By that time, Mart was nearby, her arms crossed over her sturdy body in a striking imitation of Matthew.
Not before the witch hears what I have to say. I've come to serve you with a warning, Diana Bishop. Relationships between witches and vampires are forbidden. You must leave this house and no longer associate with Matthew de Clermont or any of his family. If you don't, the congregation will take whatever steps are necessary to preserve the covenant.
I don't know your congregation, and I agreed to no such covenant, I said, still furious. Besides, covenants aren't enforceable. They're voluntary.
Are you a lawyer as well as a historian? You modern women with your fine educations are so fascinating, but women are no good at theology.
Domenico continued sorrowfully.
Which is why we never thought it worth educating you in the first place. Do you think we adhered to the ideas of that heretic Calvin when we made these promises to one another? When the covenant was sworn, it bound all vampires, demons, and witches. Past, present, and future. This is not a path you can follow or not as you please.
You've delivered your warning, Domenico, Matthew said in a voice like silk.
That's all I have to say to the witch, the Venetian replied. I have more to say to you.
Then Diana will return to the house. Get her out of here, Maman, he said tersely. This time his mother did what he asked immediately, and Mart followed.
Don't, Isabeau hissed when I turned to look back at Matthew. Where did that thing come from? Mart asked once we were safely inside. From Elle, presumably, said Isabeau.
She touched my face briefly with her fingertips, drawing them back hastily when they met the warmth of my angry cheeks.
You are brave, girl, but what you did was reckless. You are not a vampire. Do not put yourself at risk by arguing with Domenico or any of his allies. Stay away from them.
Isabeau gave me no time to respond, speeding me through the kitchens, the dining room, the salon, and into the great hall. Finally, she towed me toward the arch that led to the keep's most formidable tower. My calves seized up at the thought of the climb.
We must, she insisted. Mathieu will be looking for us there.
Fear and anger propelled me halfway up the stairs. The second half I conquered through sheer determination. Lifting my feet from the final tread, I found myself on a flat roof with a view for miles in every direction. A faint breeze blew, loosening my braided hair and coaxing the mist around me.
Isabeau moved swiftly to a pole that extended another dozen feet into the sky.
She raised a forked black banner adorned with a silver Ouroboros. It unfurled in the gloomy light, the snake holding its shimmering tail in its mouth. I ran to the far side of the crenellated walls and Domenico looked up. Moments later, a similar banner rose over the top of a building in the village and a bell began to toll. Men and women slowly came out of houses, bars, shops, and offices, their faces turned toward Settur, where the ancient symbol of eternity and rebirth snapped in the wind. I looked at Isabeau, my question evident on my face.
Our family's emblem, and a warning to the village to be on their guard, she explained. We fly the banner only when others are with us. The villagers have grown too accustomed to living among vampires, and though they have nothing to fear from us, we have kept it for times such as this. The world is full of vampires who cannot be trusted, Diana. Domenico Michele is one of them.
You didn't need to tell me that. Who the hell is he?
One of Mathieu's oldest friends, Isabeau murmured, eyes on her son, which makes him a very dangerous enemy.
My attention turned to Matthew, who continued to exchange words with Domenico across a precisely drawn zone of engagement. There was a blur of black and gray movement, and the Venetian hurtled backward toward the chestnut tree he'd been leaning against when we first spotted him. A loud crack carried across the grounds.
Well done, Isabeau muttered.
Where's Mart?
I looked over my shoulder toward the stairs.
In the hall, just in case.
Isabeau's keen eyes remained fixed on her son.
Would Domenico really come in here and rip my throat open?
Isabeau turned her black, glittering gaze on me.
That would be all too easy, my dear. He would play with you first. He always plays with his prey, and Domenico loves an audience.
I swallowed hard. I'm capable of taking care of myself.
You are, if you have as much power as Mathieu believes. Witches are very good at protecting themselves, I found, with a little effort and a drop of courage, Isabeau said.
What is this congregation that Domenico mentioned? I asked.
A council of nine, three from each order of demons, witches, and vampires. It was established during the Crusades to keep us from being exposed to the humans. We were careless and became too involved in their politics and other forms of insanity.
Isabeau's voice was bitter.
Ambition, pride, and grasping creatures like Michele who were never content with their lot in life and always wanted more. They drove us to the Covenant.
And you agreed to certain conditions? It was ludicrous to think that promises made by creatures in the Middle Ages could affect Matthew and me.
Isabeau nodded, the breeze catching a few strands of her heavy, honeyed hair and moving them around her face.
When we mixed with one another, we were too conspicuous. When we became involved in human affairs, they grew suspicious of our cleverness. They are not quick, the poor creatures, but they are not entirely stupid, either.
By mixing, you don't mean dinners and dancing.
No dinners, no dancing, and no kissing and singing songs to each other, Isabeau said pointedly. And what comes after the dancing and the kissing was forbidden as well. We were full of arrogance before we agreed to the covenant. There were more of us, and we'd become accustomed to taking whatever we wanted, no matter the cost. What else does this promise cover? No politics or religion. Too many princes and popes were otherworldly creatures. It became more difficult to pass from one life to the next once humans started writing their chronicles. Isabeau shuddered. Vampires found it difficult to feign a good death and move on to a new life with humans nosing around.
I glanced quickly at Matthew and Domenico, but they were still talking outside the chateau's walls.
So, I repeated, ticking items off my fingers. No mixing between different types of creatures? No careers in human politics or religion, anything else? Apparently, my aunt's xenophobia and fierce opposition to my studying the law derived from her imperfect understanding of this long-ago agreement.
Yes, if any creature breaks the covenant, it's the responsibility of the congregation to see that the misconduct is stopped and the oath is upheld.
And if two creatures break the covenant?
The silence stretched taut between us.
To my knowledge, it has never happened, she said grimly. It is a very good thing, therefore, that the two of you have not done so.
Last night I'd made a simple request that Matthew join me in my bed, but he'd known it wasn't a simple request. It wasn't me he was unsure of, or his feelings. Matthew wanted to know how far he could go before the congregation would intervene. The answer had come quickly. They weren't going to let us get very far at all. My relief was quickly replaced by anger. Had no one complained as our relationship developed, he might never have told me about the congregation or the covenant, and his silence would have had implications for my relationship with my own family and with his. I might have gone to my grave believing that my aunt and Isabeau were bigots. Instead, they were living up to a promise made long ago, which was less understandable, but somehow more excusable.
Your son needs to stop keeping things from me.
My temper rose, the tingling mounting in my fingertips. And you should worry less about the congregation and more about what I'm going to do when I see him again.
She snorted.
You won't get the chance to do much before he takes you to task for questioning his authority in front of Domenico.
I'm not under Matthew's authority.
You, my dear, have a great deal to learn about vampires, she said with a note of satisfaction.
And you have a great deal to learn about me. So does the congregation.
Isabeau took me by the shoulders, her fingers digging into the flesh of my arms.
This is not a game, Diana. Matthew would willingly turn his back on creatures he has known for centuries to protect your right to be whatever you imagine you want to be in your fleeting life. I'm begging you not to let him do it. They will kill him if he persists.
He's his own man, Isabeau, I said coldly. I don't tell Matthew what to do.
No, but you have the power to send him away. Tell him you refuse to break the covenant for him, for his sake, or that you feel nothing more for him than curiosity, witches are famous for it. She flung me away. If you love him, you'll know what to say.
It is over,
Mart called from the top of the stairs. We both rushed to the edge of the tower. A black horse and rider streaked out of the stables and cleared the paddock fence before thundering into the forest. Chapter 22. We'd been waiting in the salon, the three of us, since he'd ridden off on Balthazar in the late morning. Now the shadows were lengthening toward twilight. A human would be half dead from the prolonged effort needed to control that enormous horse in the open countryside. However, the events of the morning had reminded me that Matthew wasn't human, but a vampire, with many secrets, a complicated past, and frightening enemies. Overhead, a door closed.
He's back. He will go to his father's room, as he always does when he is troubled, Isabeau explained.
Matthew's beautiful young mother sat and stared at the fire while I wrung my hands in my lap, refusing everything Mart put in front of me. I hadn't eaten since breakfast, but my hollowness had nothing to do with hunger. I felt shattered, surrounded by the broken pieces of my formerly ordered life. My degree from Oxford, my position at Yale, and my carefully researched and written books had long provided meaning and structure to my life. But none of them were of comfort to me in this strange new world of menacing vampires and threatening witches. My exposure to it had left me raw, with the new fragility linked to a vampire and the invisible, undeniable movement of a witch's blood in my veins. At last Matthew entered the salon, clean and dressed in fresh clothes. His eyes sought me out immediately, their cold touch fluttering over me as he checked that I was unharmed. His mouth softened in relief. It was the last hint of comforting familiarity that I detected in him. The vampire who entered the salon was not the Matthew that I knew. He was not the elegant, charming creature who had slipped into my life with a mocking smile and invitations to breakfast. Nor was he the scientist, absorbed in his work and preoccupied with the question of why he was here. And there was no sign of the Matthew who had swung me into his arms and kissed me with such passionate intensity only the night before. This Matthew was cold and impassive. The few soft edges he'd once possessed, around his mouth, in the delicacy of his hands, the stillness of his eyes, had been replaced by hard lines and angles. He seemed older than I remembered, a combination of weariness and careful remove reflecting every moment of his nearly 1,500 years of age. A log broke in the fireplace. The sparks caught my eye, burning blood orange as they fell in the grate. Nothing but the color red appeared at first. Then the red took on a texture, strands of red burnished here and there with gold and silver. The texture became a thing, hair. Sarah's hair. My fingers caught the strap of a backpack from my shoulder, and I dropped my lunchbox on the floor of the family room with the same officious clatter as my father when he dropped his briefcase by the door.
I'm home!
My child's voice was high and bright.
Are there cookies?
Sarah's head turned, red and orange, catching the sparks in the late afternoon light. But her face was pure white. The white overwhelmed the other colors, became silver, and assumed a texture like the scales of a fish. Chainmail clung to a familiar, muscular body. Matthew.
I'm through.
His white hands tore at a black tunic with a silver cross on the front, rending it at the shoulders. He flung it at someone's feet, turned, and strode away. With a single blink of my eyes, the vision was gone, replaced by the warm tones of the salon at set tour, but the startling knowledge of what had happened lingered. As with the witch wind, there had been no warning when this hidden talent of mine was released. Had my mother's visions come on so suddenly and had such clarity? I glanced around the room, but the only creature who seemed to have noticed something was odd was Mart, who looked at me with concern. Matthew went to Isabeau and kissed her lightly on both of her flawless white cheeks.
I'm so sorry, Maman, he murmured.
He was always a peak. It's not your fault.
Isabeau gave her son's hand a gentle squeeze.
I'm glad you are home.
He's gone. There's nothing to worry about tonight, Matthew said, his mouth tight.
He drew his fingers through his hair.
Drink.
Mart belonged to the sustenance school of crisis management. She handed a glass of wine to Matthew and plunked yet another cup of tea next to me. It sat on the table untouched, sending tendrils of steam into the room.
Thank you, Mart.
Matthew drank deeply. As he did, his eyes returned to mine, but he deliberately looked away as he swallowed.
My phone, he said, turning toward his study.
He descended the stairs a few moments later.
For you.
He gave me the phone in such a way that our hands didn't need to touch.
I knew who was on the line.
Hello, Sarah.
I've been calling for more than 8 hours. What on earth is wrong?
Sarah knew something bad was happening. She wouldn't have called a vampire otherwise. Her tense voice conjured up the image of her white face from my vision. She'd been frightened in it, not just sad. There's nothing wrong, I said, not wanting her to be scared anymore. I'm with Matthew.
Being with Matthew is what got you into this trouble in the first place.
Sarah, I can't talk now. The last thing I needed was to argue with my aunt.
She drew in her breath.
Diana, there are a few things you need to know before you decide to throw in your lot with a vampire.
Really? I asked, my temper flaring. Do you think now is the time to tell me about the Covenant? You don't by any chance know the witches who are among the current members of the congregation, do you? I have a few things I'd like to say to them.
My fingers were burning, and the skin under my nails had become a vivid sky blue.
You turned your back on your power, Diana, and refused to talk about magic. The Covenant wasn't relevant to your life, nor was the congregation.
Sarah sounded defensive. My bitter laugh helped the blue tinge fade from my fingers.
Justify it any way you want, Sarah. After Mom and Dad were killed, you and Em should have told me, and not just hinted at something in mysterious half-truths. But it's too late now. I need to talk to Matthew. I'll call you tomorrow.
After severing the connection and flinging the phone onto the ottoman at my feet, I closed my eyes and waited for the tingling in my fingers to subside. All three vampires were staring at me. I could feel it.
So, I said into the silence, are we to expect more visitors from this congregation?
Matthew's mouth tightened.
No.
It was a one-word answer, but at least it was the word I wanted to hear. Over the past few days, I'd had a respite from Matthew's mood changes, and had almost forgotten how alarming they could be. His next words wiped away my hope that this latest outburst would soon pass.
There will be no visits from the congregation because we aren't going to break the covenant. We'll stay here for a few more days, then return to Oxford. Is that all right with you, Mama?
Of course,
Isabeau replied promptly. She sighed with relief.
We should keep the standard flying, Matthew continued, his voice businesslike. The village should know to be on its guard.
Isabeau nodded, and her son took a sip of his wine. I stared, first at one and then the other. Neither responded to my silent demand for more information.
It's only been a few days since you took me out of Oxford, I said after no one rose to my wordless challenge.
Matthew's eyes lifted to mine in forbidding response.
Now you're going back, he said evenly. Meanwhile, there will be no walks outside the grounds, no riding on your own.
His present coldness was more frightening than anything Domenico had said.
And?
I pressed him.
No more dancing, Matthew said, his abruptness suggesting that a host of other activities were included in this category. We're going to abide by the congregation's rules. If we stop aggravating them, they'll turn their attention to more important matters.
I see. You want me to play dead. And you'll give up your work and Ashmole 782? I don't believe that.
I stood and moved toward the door. Matthew's hand was rough on my arm. It violated all the laws of physics that he could have reached my side so quickly.
Sit down, Diana.
His voice was as rough as his touch, but it was oddly gratifying that he was showing any emotion at all.
Why are you giving in? I whispered.
To avoid exposing us all to the humans, and to keep you alive. He pulled me back to the sofa and pushed me onto the cushions.
This family is not a democracy, especially not at a time like this. When I tell you to do something, you do it, without hesitation or question. Understood?
Matthew's tone indicated that the discussion was over.
Or what?
I was deliberately provoking him, but his aloofness frightened me. He put down his wine, and the crystal captured the light from the candles. I felt myself falling, this time into a pool of water. The pool became a drop, the drop a tear glistening on a white cheek. Sarah's cheeks were covered in tears, her eyes red and swollen. Em was in the kitchen. When she joined us, it was evident that she'd been crying too. She looked devastated.
What? I said, fear gripping my stomach. What's happened?
Sarah wiped at her eyes, her fingers stained with the herbs and spices she used in her spellcasting. Her fingers grew longer,
The stain's dissolving.
What? Matthew said, his eyes wild, white fingers brushing a tiny blood-stained tear from an equally white cheek. What's happened?
Witches. They have your father, Isabeau said, her voice breaking. As the vision faded, I searched for Matthew, hoping his eyes would exert their usual pull and relieve my lingering disorientation. As soon as our glances met, he came and hovered over me, but there was none of the usual comfort associated with his presence.
I will kill you myself before I let anyone hurt you. The words caught in his throat, and I don't want to kill you, so please do what I tell you.
So that's it? I asked when I could manage it. We're going to abide by an ancient, narrow-minded agreement made almost 1,000 years ago? Case closed?
You mustn't be under the congregation scrutiny. You have no control over your magic and no understanding of your relationship to Ashmole 782. At Set Tool you may be protected from Peter Knox, Diana, but I've told you before that you aren't safe around vampires. No warm blood is, ever.
You won't hurt me. In spite of what had happened over the past several days, on this point I was absolutely certain.
You persist in this romantic vision of what it is to be a vampire, but despite my best efforts to curb it, I have a taste for blood.
I made a dismissive gesture. You've killed humans, I know this, Matthew. You're a vampire and you've lived for hundreds of years. Do you think I imagine you survived on nothing but animals?
Isabeau was watching her son closely.
Saying you know I've killed humans and understanding what that means are two different things, Diana. You have no idea what I'm capable of.
He touched his talisman from Bethany and moved away from me with swift, impatient steps.
I know who you are.
Here was another point of absolute certainty. I wondered what made me so instinctively sure of Matthew, as the evidence about the brutality of vampires, even witches, mounted.
You don't know yourself. And 3 weeks ago you'd never heard of me.
Matthew's gaze was restless, and his hands, like mine, were shaking. This worried me less than the fact that Isabeau had pitched farther forward in her seat. He picked up a poker and gave the fire a vicious thrust before throwing it aside. The metal rang against the stone, gouging the hard surface as if it were butter.
We will figure this out. Give us some time. I tried to make my voice low and soothing.
There's nothing to figure out. Matthew was pacing now. You have too much undisciplined power. It's like a drug. A highly addictive, dangerous drug that other creatures are desperate to share. You'll never be safe so long as a witch or vampire is near you.
My mouth opened to respond, but the place where he'd been standing was empty. Matthew's icy fingers were on my chin, lifting me to my feet.
I'm a predator, Diana.
He said it with the seductiveness of a lover. The dark aroma of cloves made me dizzy. I have to hunt and kill to survive. He turned my face away from him with a savage twist, exposing my neck. His restless eyes raked over my throat.
Mathieu, put Diana down.
Isabeau sounded unconcerned, and my own faith in him remained unshaken. He wanted to frighten me off for some reason, but I was in no real danger, not as I'd been with Domenico.
She thinks she knows me, Mama, he purred, but Diana doesn't know what it's like when the craving for a warm blood tightens your stomach so much that you're mad with need. She doesn't know how much we want to feel the blood of another heart pulsing through our veins, or how difficult it is for me to stand here, so close, and not taste her.
Isabeau rose but remained where she was.
Now is not the time to teach her, Matthew.
You see, it's not just that I could kill you outright, he continued, ignoring his mother. His black eyes were mesmerizing. I could feed on you slowly, taking your blood and letting it replenish, only to begin again the next day. His grip moved from my chin to circle my neck, and his thumb stroked the pulse at my throat as if he were gauging just where to sink his teeth into my flesh.
Stop it, I said sharply. His scare tactics had gone on long enough.
Matthew dropped me abruptly on the soft carpet. By the time I felt the impact, the vampire was across the room, his back to me and his head bowed. I stared at the pattern on the rug beneath my hands and knees. A swirl of colors, too many to distinguish, moved before my eyes. They were leaves dancing against the sky, green, brown, blue, gold. "It's your mom and dad," Sarah was explaining, her voice tight. "They've been killed. They're gone, honey." I dragged my eyes from the carpet to the vampire standing with his back to me. "No," I shook my head. "What is it, Diana?" Matthew turned, concern momentarily pushing the predator away. The swirl of colors captured my attention again. Green, brown, blue, gold. They were leaves, caught in an eddy on a pool of water, falling onto the ground around my hands. A bow, curved and polished, rested next to a scattering of arrows and a half-empty quiver. I reached for the bow, and felt the taut string cut into my flesh. "Mathieu," Isabeau warned, sniffing the air delicately.
"I know. I can smell it too," he said grimly.
"He's yours," a strange voice whispered. "You mustn't let him go." "I know," I murmured impatiently.
"What do you know, Diana?"
Matthew took a step toward me.
Mart shot to my side. "Leave her," she hissed. "The child is not in this world."
I was nowhere, caught between the terrible ache of losing my parents and the certain knowledge that soon Matthew, too, would be gone. "Be careful," the strange voice warned.
"It's too late for that."
I raised my hand from the floor and smashed it into the bow, snapping it in two. "Much too late."
"What's too late?" Matthew asked.
"I've fallen in love with you."
"You can't have," he said numbly.
The room was utterly silent, except for the crackling of the fire. "It's too soon." "Why do vampires have such a strange attitude toward time?" I mused aloud, still caught in a bewildering mix of past and present. The word love had sent feelings of possessiveness through me, however, drawing me to the here and now.
"Witches don't have centuries to fall in love. We do it quickly. Sarah says my mother fell in love with my father the moment she saw him. I've loved you since I decided not to hit you with an oar on the city of Oxford's dock."
The blood in my veins began to hum. Mart looked startled, suggesting she could hear it too.
"You don't understand."
It sounded as if Matthew, like the bow, might snap in too.
"I do. The congregation will try to stop me, but they won't tell me who to love.
When my parents were taken from me, I was a child with no options and did what people told me. I was an adult now, and I was going to fight for Matthew."
"Domenico's overtures are nothing compared with what you can expect from Peter Knox. What happened today was an attempt at rapprochement, a diplomatic mission. You aren't ready to face the congregation, Diana, no matter what you think. And if you did stand up to them, what then? Bringing these old animosities to the surface could spin out of control, expose us to humans. Your family might suffer."
Matthew's words were brutal, meant to make me stop and reconsider. But nothing he said outweighed what I felt for him.
"I love you, and I'm not going to stop."
Of this, too, I was certain.
"You are not in love with me."
"I decide who I love, and how, and when. Stop telling me what to do, Matthew. My ideas about vampires may be romantic, but your attitudes toward women need a major overhaul."
Before he could respond, his phone began to hop across the ottoman. He swore an oath in Occitan that must have been truly awe-inspiring, because even Mart looked shocked. He reached down and snagged the phone before it could skitter onto the floor.
"What is it?" he said, his eyes fixed on me.
There were faint murmurs on the other end of the line. Mart and Isabeau exchanged worried glances.
"When?"
Matthew's voice sounded like a gunshot.
"Did they take anything?"
My forehead creased at the anger in his voice.
"Thank God. Was there damage?"
"Something had happened in Oxford while we were gone, and it sounded like a robbery. I hoped it wasn't the old lodge." The voice on the other end of the phone continued. Matthew passed a hand over his eyes.
What else? He asked, his voice rising.
There was another long silence. He turned away and walked to the fireplace, his right hand splayed flat against the mantel.
So much for diplomacy.